It's Great Mondays Radio, a podcast exploring how work is changing in the age of AI. I'm Josh Levine, a transformation executive helping private businesses elevate how their teams operate in an AI-driven world. On the show, I speak with executives, people leaders, and other humans rethinking how decisions get made, how managers lead, and how teams are learning to adapt. If you'd like to be a guest on our program, hang out for about 30 minutes, and I'll tell you how. What does it mean for people to get a job these days, and how do we prove what we know beyond skills on a resume? I have with us today an incredible guest who has deep domain knowledge on what it means to learn, get credentialed, and what it means to get a job in this kind of crazy world we live in. Josh Silverman, a longtime friend. He is the founder and CEO of People Work Partners. He brings a humane design lens to recruiting and leadership coaching, placing emerging leaders in roles at Target, Cisco, Netflix, OpenAI, and more. And we are going to get into it about how the world is changing. And he's going to teach us a little bit about what he's been thinking about called the knowledge continuum. Josh Silverman, welcome to Great Mondays Radio.
Thanks, Josh. Thank you. So glad to be here. So glad to have a conversation with you and others who are listening. Welcome, everyone.
So you've spent a lot of time in your career inside of educational institutions. And correct. I want to start our conversation there. So
great.
Give us a little bit of your kind of, to get us into the ballpark around, you know, how you got into teaching, what it means to run a department at a design school, and then we'll get into the crisis that some of these schools are facing and what it might mean. So let's start with you and the kind of the expertise you have earned, hard-earned expertise, blood, sweat, and tears of living in a design school.
Yeah, well, thanks for making the time for us to have this conversation. I'm a lifelong learner. I love to teach because I also love to learn. I owe a lot of this to Liz Resnick, who was chair of the design program at Mass Art, Mass College of Art in Boston, when we were all there. Mm-hmm. Liz was the education chair, I believe, of AIGA Boston when I was volunteering as membership person, go-to.
AIGA being the National Design Association that we both grew up in.
That's right. Yeah. And expanded our network. And so Liz said to me one day, we got to get you in a classroom. And I was like, okay. And I did not think that I wanted to teach, but I've been teaching for 30 years. I taught at Mass Art, AIB, Art Institute of Boston, that was acquired by Leslie. I taught at RISD. When I moved out to the Bay, I taught at General Assembly. I've led workshops around the globe, and for the past, I actually taught a class at Creative Live, which was really interesting to experience 20,000 people live streaming my class on Creative Live, which was an incredible experience. I've been teaching on maven.com, and for the last 10 years, I've been teaching at California College of the Arts, RIP. If you went to CCAC, California College of the Arts and Crafts, you still refer to it as CCAC. But CCA has been an incredible experience. I was an adjunct for a couple of years, and then I was chair of the Master of Interaction Design program. Started March 2020. Lo and behold, we know what happened March 2020. The internet became the home for a lot of learning, as it had been already. And when I was chair during those first couple pandemic years, it really radicalized my understanding of where and how learning takes place. I was very surprised to start chairing March 2020, but also quite humbled that I got to run this program and lead this program, the MDES program, in our Zoom rectangles, in these rectangles. It didn't really matter where your body was based. It mattered that you wanted to learn and that you wanted to teach and be part of this program, no matter where you were based, because you had the knowledge and you had the interest and could make the time.
So this then brings us, so what I think you had a unique opportunity or a unique moment. You were at the right place at the right time, or the wrong place at the wrong time, but let's say the right place at the right time,
It was right. That's right.
to understand the absolute earthquake that is still rippling through our education system.
Yes.
Because traditional, and this is what you said before we started recording, traditional small independent colleges and educational institutions are real estate based. And what
Yes.
does it mean when the world, right, place based? What does it mean when the world goes online? Now, of course, I've talked a lot about this, in work and offices, but haven't really, and other people that you have thought more about this. So, how did we, so what is happening now in the that is sort of the result of this? We're starting to see it 5 years later, 6 years later. What's going on with these schools and how they've changed or haven't changed? What are the symptoms of that?
The easiest, most succinct way I can put it, Josh, is that a lot of schools that were doubling down on place-based in-person learning, and I'm not knocking that that's important and valuable. I love going to campus. I love running into people that I wouldn't have otherwise run into on Zoom. You can't really program spontaneity like that on Zoom yet. But having a critique where things are on a wall and you get to point to one student's work and say, "You and you are solving similar problems. You should chat with each other and think through that together." Can't replace that kind of looking at things together in a holistic kind of way. And I love that for place-based learning, and that's still important. There's so many programs that you can't do online, like furniture and all the like handcraft is a lot harder to do online, even though, bless her heart, the furniture chair figured out how to ship things to students who wanted to learn furniture making during the pandemic. But place-based learning is still important, and we live in a multiverse where, when I was chair of MDes, I was able to diversify the faculty perspectives by hiring people who didn't need to be based in the Bay, weren't coming to campus. That helped the program unlearn a lot of the cis white male perspectives that present company excluded, were part of the dominant ethos of design learning for quite some time. So, two things happened when I was chair that helped me think through where and how learning takes place, and that it's more important to have the people. It's more important to focus on the person doing the learning rather than where the learning is taking place. So if I learn culture from Josh Levine, that should stand for something. If I learn systems thinking from Hugh Dubberly, that should stand for something because it came from those people. I came from Jorge Arango, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of value to the people who have the knowledge, and less so maybe the institution that they're a part of. So that shift is the first thing that's starting to take place for me. The second is access. And I'll never forget this student who wanted to come to the program when the pandemic was over and we were no longer offering hybrid or Zoom classes. This student based in Mexico, "How come we're not live streaming what we're teaching on campus?" And I said, "I wish that we could. I wanted to accommodate the student." Access is critical for lifelong learning, not just a grad program, not just an isolated grad program in interaction design, but to be able to level the playing field of who gets to learn and where it takes place, that's the way I want learning to go. That's the way I want learning to go for everyone, not just people who want to come to California, to San Francisco to learn in a master's program. So real estate is really expensive, period. It's particularly expensive in the Bay. And when Vanderbilt University, who is acquiring CCA, this conversation had been going on for at least a year plus, but we, the faculty and staff and students, all found out about it this January, a week before classes started, or actually 2 weeks before classes started. So it was a bit of a shock to everyone. And I had students coming in my classes from Ghana and Korea who were like, I wouldn't have come to the US had I known that this was happening. And I wish that they didn't have to come to the US, but could still learn from our faculty if they wanted to. So what Vanderbilt is doing is making another real estate acquisition with CCA's beautiful award-winning new building. There were so many things that happened in the last couple of years pre-pandemic that I think forced CCA's hand. But it left a bad taste in my mouth because Vanderbilt sent out this when the press announcement was made and we all found out, Vanderbilt included in their press release that they wanted to connect with people who had a long-standing impact in the Bay Area community. And I thought, they haven't reached out to us. They don't even know who we are. Let us show you around. Let us introduce you to who we are. So maybe some of the faculty who've taught at CCA for 10, 20, 30, 40 years could continue to be part of the Vanderbilt community if they wanted that. I don't know anyone, no faculty that I know has had a conversation with Vanderbilt about the transition to being a Vanderbilt university. CCA is going to have a couple of its holdings, maybe some curricula being introduced to Vanderbilt, but it's TBD. So to get to your to get to your answer about like what's happening, SFAI closed, Mills closed, CCA is closing, Hampshire is closing. This is the beginning of a series of rolling blackouts of independent colleges of art and design that, or not even art and design. Hampshire is not an art and design
Neither's
college.
Mills.
These are signals that there's something that needs to change, and this is a really good time to reinvent some systems.
Do you think that, I guess, if I were to draw a parallel, right? So where are what we're looking at is a difficult economic environment, and there's no question that this kind of distributed in virtual learning opportunity, whether that's someone skips, a degree altogether or can take, can actually learn outside of that system virtually. Is it your opinion that these organizations, if they had taken some of those steps to be more broadly accessible to stream, like would that have been able to, if they embraced it, stave off this kind of closing, like if they were to kind of this, let me finish my thought here because a thousand things just rushed into my head as I was saying that. Would that been able to save some of these universities, at least in part? And is it because they couldn't evolve that they are like, this is what I think I hear you saying, but I just want to make sure that I understand.
Thanks for the opportunity to clarify. I'm not running CCA, the institution, but from where I stood as chair, or where I sat as chair, I guess, where I stood as chair and what I had access to in terms of the P&L and how that program was a money-making program for the college. And I see all those things, and I also hear in the same continuum that I had to scrounge for honoraria to invite speakers. I had to limit my faculty to have a couple honoraria per semester to pay the guest speakers. It wasn't balancing out. So I can't really say with as much efficacy as I'd like to how we could have expanded the course offerings, the access, the programs, the centers. When CCA's final president, David Howes, started as president, he was learning from us, the chairs, about our different programs and where we came from, what we had to offer. With some of my core faculty, we presented 14 different interventions and new revenue streams that could have helped, could have been some contributor to the bottom line. But the biggest whiff on CCA's part was that they didn't include any of the faculty who teach business model innovation in the conversations that ultimately led to the decisions that they had to make. So had we been brought in sooner when the problem became a problem, not when the problem was We have no other choices now. That's what it felt like. Again, I don't really know, but
It's old thinking, I think. Classical style thinking, right? Like very hierarchical. This is a 120-year-old institution for better or worse.
Yes.
Okay,
Well,
and
it's worse now. It's not better.
I mean, yes, it's credibility, right? The fondness with which you know, it's like this was an incredible institution of the arts and crafts movement, right? So that's
Yes.
better, you know, that's to me is kind of the legacy and the heritage. That's all that I was referring to.
Yes.
The you know, it's to me there's also there was that panic, the parallels, the panic in the corporate world where you had like, hey, you have to come back. Real estate's really expensive,
Yes.
undisclosed, you know, but like, hey, this is really important. And, you know, last week I read a piece that said essentially kind of the best balance is a hybrid in and out for workers, right? 2 to 3
Yes.
days in and out.
Yes.
Like that is like the most productive. You don't feel isolated. You get some
Totally.
time back, right? So to me, there's this parallel of like being forced to evolve. And there's probably because there's more businesses than there are institutions, there's plenty of businesses that have probably failed and plenty, you know, more that have scaled up because of whatever happened during the pandemic. Things changed,
Yes.
the models changed.
Yes. Talent wants to live where talent wants to live. People want to live where they're happiest. Everyone should be able to live in a place that they find beautiful and have a good balance of environment and the occasional commute. And you know, having taught in DMBA, that the low residency approach to getting things done was sufficient. People were able to do the work and get the degree with the low residency approach. And in case listeners are not familiar, the low residency approach was, I think you, depending on when you wanted to fly into DMBA, you flew to campus. Classes were like all day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then you'd go away for the next 3 weeks and then come back the next
That's
month.
right. So it was, yeah, that's right. Exactly. So it was 1 4-day block, Thursday through Sunday.
Thursday through Sunday,
Every
okay.
month, every month. And there were plenty of people that lived in the Bay Area
And a
and
lot who
who
didn't.
worked, and a lot of people who didn't.
You could
And
have a
that
life.
was it was a really like, and actually for a while, when I moved to Portland, I continued to teach
I remember
because I
that.
could fly down. I
Yes.
couldn't do that if it was every day.
Right.
So there was definitely some innovative. Yeah, there's some things that were changing there that were really interesting. So there's things. So we have this. So okay, we've set up the preface for this. So now
Great.
let's get into chapter one. So
That
of our conversation, right? So the
was
pref
page zero.
that was a big preface, but
Yeah.
worthwhile.
Yeah.
So here we are. You're actively with your in your work. You work with folks that are early or mid-career. Correct me if I'm wrong. To find the kinds of jobs that where they're going to be an incredible fit, the right culture, the right kind of growth path for the skills that they have, right? So that's your perspective, that's what you're looking at. And you inherently have to understand where they've come from and what they have learned.
Yes.
So when you see a failure of the educational system, or at least the brittling of the educational system, what, and I'm looking at, and you're experiencing as well, this completely turned over job market, you're seeing opportunity for change. And so I want to hear a little bit more about how people should be thinking about proving the value what they know beyond skills, because we know from the AI discourse, right, the idea of bundling skills, right? So if you have one skill, it's easy to be replaced, AI or humans, versus a bundling of skills. So how do we prove, like, give me your kind of what you've been chewing on around the way that both parts of this system are changing.
Absolutely. That was several questions, but I'll do my best to answer them
I
one
know.
at a time.
I got to get better at just asking one question. I know.
No. If your question is everything, tell me about everything, then you're covered. So what I'm thinking through these days is a knowledge continuum. We have early childhood school, we have college, high school, college workshops, learning by doing. We have internships. We have more workshops, maybe. Once we leave a school environment and we're in a work environment, I don't think the learning should stop. And for some people, it doesn't. You have L&D budgets, learning and development budgets from your employers. You might have a lunch and learn. You might have some other kinds of like corporate programming where there's, or employee sponsored programming where there's employee resource groups. There's plenty of ways to keep your learning going, even if you're not at school. So I'm thinking that there can be some continuum of skills in, knowledge in, and skills out, knowledge out, that is connected, that is a through line between what we've learned, who teaches it, where we learned it, how we deployed it, and then what we do with it when we're at work. And that would help a lot of recruiters, myself included, make a better match, perform the work of matching people to environments better when we know where the knowledge came from, when we know who did the work and who taught us those things and how it has been demonstrated before. You said something about failure, and I just want to give a little sidebar to like failure and what I think about as failure. Failure is data. Failure is a moment in time. Failure is not final if you have a growth mindset, which we do. When you are in a institution that is failing, you get to decide if you want to double down on it and continue to commit to it. But I think more often than not, you can separate yourself from the institution that has failed or that is failing you by maintaining that growth mindset and thinking, okay, what can I take from this? How do I ask better questions to join the next institution or ask better questions the next time so that I don't have to suffer alongside other people? So anyway, that aside, there does not seem to be some kind of continuum of knowledge that I would love to publish and make open source, because every one of us is smarter than one of us. And if there were a way to say, I learned culture jamming and culture development from Josh Levine, and I learned, just going to keep using the examples that I used earlier, systems thinking from Hugh Deberly and information architecture from Jorge Arango. Both Hugh and Jorge and yourself were CCA faculty or are CCA faculty. If there's a way to say, ah, I know that you are capable of these things because of who taught you these things and because you've deployed these things in other project teams or other full-time employee or part-time employee ways, then I know more about, I the recruiter will be able to help you get a meaningful job for the things that you know, if there is some kind of through line between knowledge in and skills out. And I
Isn't
don't see that right now.
it isn't that Is that what you try to do, or recruiters try to do, but with less information now? You try to see the through line.
Yes, it's I've placed a couple candidates. I've been connecting designers, mostly designers, to opportunities for 30 years. Design and design adjacent people, content people, engineers, product people. It's fascinating to me, the more that I've focused in on recruiting the last couple of years as I've stepped down from chair, it's fascinating to me that it works at all. But a lot of it is guesswork. A lot of it is vibes. A lot of it, you just get better and better and better at sussing out people in those first 30 minutes when you have a phone screen. But all the work that a designer puts into their projects, and then all the work that the designer puts into the project portfolio, telling you the case studies about what you should know about the impact, both qual and quant. Most recruiters spend a minute, 2 minutes looking at a portfolio before having enough information to start to yay or nay them in a pile, in a categorization. Should we chat with this person? Should we reach out to this person or not? And it's amazing that it does work as it is right now, as the system is set up right now, because it seems like a lot of vibes, and I want it to mean more than that. It's also super transactional. You know, you're a warm body with Figma skills. Here's your role. Good luck. Peace out. And I want there to be a little bit more relational support around that?
I have always thought that even, I think designers as a perfect example have a much better chance of demonstrating their value than because they have more than just a resume. And now you see that with folks who are publishing or can demonstrate the projects that they have on GitHub or that they've done before. And I even read an article last week that was essentially saying, look, if you want to get an interview, build something that's valuable to this person. And because now you can, and you can spend that time. And so to me, what I think is really a piece of the puzzle is showing you the work product, not telling you about the work product.
Absolutely. And I've been teaching a portfolio class, portfolio making class, for the last 10 years at CCA and elsewhere. I teach it on Maven. And the thing that designers need to do more than anything else, if there's one thing that a designer listening to this podcast episode can do to their portfolio, is put impact first. Here's the setup, and then here's the impact. That's like first slide is like what I did, how I came to this opportunity, what my role was. The next thing you need to put in your slide deck is the impact slide. Don't it's not the design process, it's the interview process. And because recruiters don't take a lot of time poring over each of their candidates' portfolios, putting the impact slide second will hook the listeners to think through the rest of the design process. So, yeah, impact is important. It can come in lots of forms, qual and quant, and both are valid. Both are important. You need a good testimonial, and you need the business impact or the time saved, money earned, etc.
So before we start casting, making our guesses about what we might want to see in the future, is it possible for someone who is not a front-end developer or a visual designer, like what is that version that they can do today, right? If you're not like, hey, I'm applying to create an app, like to be part of that, right? Like I know anybody can make a site and can make a, but like how do you help other people move beyond the resume and just these like that to me, like how do you dem today, how do we demonstrate value?
Value comes in many forms. I think the most basic fundamental answer I can give you is that if it's not coming in a measurable, quantifiable way, time saved, money earned, bottom line impact, qualitative value is just as important. So I learned how to research this thing better because of this collaborator that I worked with, or working with this person helped me approach content strategy in a different way, or storytelling became really much more important because we, whatever the thing is, like the experiential part is just as valid as the business part. And I think in the age of AI, when things are accelerating and becoming harder to over-index on the, sorry, in the age of AI, it's going to become important to over-index on the people part, on the fundamental human thing that AI can't do yet. So if we can over-index on the qual, that's a good thing to demonstrate value.
Okay, so then let's move that forward because I do think that's one of the underlying tenets of your hypothesis around what we can be doing. So what is if we need to move beyond articulating skills, like that is absolutely, I think, a clear as day what we need to be doing. Because that's the value, I think, very shortly, if they haven't already, organizations are going to understand, right? You can't be, turns out you can't be, people can't be replaced with AI. So, how might the future look in the market when you are trying to prove the human value of, right? What's the soft skills version of the portfolio?
Sure. So soft skills are misnamed, and we chatted about this before we hit record, but soft skills are way harder to get really good at, harder than hard skills, I think. Hard skills, if you're unfamiliar, are the technical skills, the shipping, the coding, the probably more quantitative skills, soft skills, or the qualitative experiential skills. Those are harder because they persist. And luckily, if you're good at people, those are the things that will carry you through from project to project, from job to job. I can tell you the story in a couple of ways. One is that I've been reading this really lovely book, Relationality. Shout out to David J. It's funny because I'll just read the subtitle: How Moving from Transactional to Transformational Relationships Can Reshape Our Lonely World. He's spot on, and it's an extremely well-researched work about being more relational. Recruiting is pretty transactional. Jobs can be pretty transactional. Projects can be pretty transactional. And what I mean by that is, like I said it earlier, like, you're a warm body with skills. Here's your nice new role.
It's all
Take
trans,
care.
like our whole, the whole business system is transaction, right? Like, tell me what money you made, time saved, you did. Like, it's all, every, fundamentally, this is about transactions, right?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. The other way I can tell you the story is that it's through a placement. When I was chair and I was coaching a founder, I love to have a, I have a, I've had a coaching practice, and I love to coach founders. This is a founder who was about to exit from one business and start up another one. And his name is Matthew. I'll leave his last name out of it. Matthew was thinking with me in our coaching sessions about his new business, whether he wanted a co-founder or not, how to set up his business, how to set up the niche that his agency was going to go after. And we spitballed structure and team. And because I had a design business for 20 years, I was like, I got you on ops and content strategy and designers. Like, you need people in my network. I can help you find those people. One person that he hired pretty early on, named Emily, was a fresh grad of my program and had a background in the niche his company was trying to go after. So I introduced Emily and Matthew. Emily has been at this company for 6 years now and is now a partner. She started out as a senior designer, I think was her title, and has worked her way up to partner. I did some recruiting for that agency for a couple of roles. I helped find other senior designers, web designers, ops people, content people. So it was amazing to support that business as in its pre-infancy and also as it was growing. But to be able to support and nurture the person who's in the role and check in with them, how it's going, not just making the introductions, but nurturing the conversation over the years, that's the thing that AI can't do. And I think that's also missing from recruiting. It can be true, and I've done this with a couple of other placements besides Emily. It can be true that once you've transplanted the kidney into the body, you check up that the kidney's accepted in the new system. You can't just be like, boop, here you go. And I think that's missing. And I think that this harkens back to the other kind of conversation we were having about knowledge in. Learning never stops, so relationships shouldn't either. If you're gonna put a person in a new role, it would be ideal to check in with them for the first 90 days, which are critical to make impact, but also like 6 months afterwards and a year afterwards. Like, what's your trajectory? This is all in the candidate side of the house. Similarly, Josh, I'd love to do this for the client side of the house, where a founder comes to me and says, I need a founding designer, but I would love to have some sense of the design hiring roadmap for the next couple of years. I would love to work with someone on that, not just the first hire, but the second, the third, and the 10th.
It and that is so antithetical to how hiring is seen today. And it's the imbalance that is making it's just, we are moving, or these organizations, startups and the like, are moving so fast. They're like, crap, I need a blank. And then it's, they post it, and then they get a million resumes, and it's like, then they choose, they pick one, They figure it out, right? They move through that process as fast as possible. And what I hear you saying is, and the prioritization is that quarter. And what I hear you arguing for is a more expansive generational kind of discussion. And it makes a lot of sense, but your value tomorrow is very hard to sell, right? Solving pain today is a lot easier. And you're making the case, and I have that vision too. And I just, I believe in that. And it's how do we create a system? Not that you're going to be able to answer this question. I think this is the question we need to be asking. How do we create a system that is robust enough to provide that kind of immediate need, but also retain the knowledge for and build, get better in as it moves into the future, which I think is actually where AI can be really useful.
I hope so. Yeah, I think to your point, maybe thinking through the value of a bad hire, the cost of a bad hire, not the value, the cost of a bad hire. If you have an immediate need and pain today is the thing you're trying to solve, I get it. I've been there. I understand. Maybe you don't want to hire someone full time for that immediate need. You could have a fractional or a project-based role where there's a curing period for how that candidate works with you and vice versa to rebalance the who's responsible for a good match. This is another issue that I have with existing recruiting. 100% of the onus is on the candidate to prove their value. And we know you wrote a book about this, and this is part of your work. We know that culture is really, really important to the success of that person. So beyond the kidney metaphor, you can't really like plant a pomegranate tree in the tropics. It's not going to work. You have to make sure that the environment is right for the person. So if we are able to measure and quantify the cost of a bad hire, and we think longer term, we zoom out from the current immediate need this week, this month, this quarter, and we think through longer term planning, take 5 more minutes to think about a hiring roadmap for the next, 3 quarters, 4 quarters. That's going to start to heal a lot of the broken systems that are in place, and to be able to help other companies beyond this one hire, I'm going to open source whatever I learn. I'm just going to keep publishing what I learn so that everything can get smarter, and it's not just me holding the knowledge because I like to teach. I like to share.
Exactly, which brings us back to the very beginning. It to me sounds like zooming out to a holistic hiring perspective and how that can be valuable to it's and I think I am thinking about the scourge of the scarcity mindset that we all are swimming in right now. And I would think that really what we want is to help folks, like you said, take 5 minutes to think, what is the next hire? How is this fitting into the longer business plan? And then I think on the front end, you're absolutely right. There's gonna be, and I'm part of an organization that is 100% geared towards, community of practice geared towards fractional. Like that is a thing that is going to be more and more part and parcel of how we do business. And yeah, I'm starting to see kind of what maybe you're describing here. And I do see a role for AI. I think there's parts that's like the human plays a role and then the AI plays a role, like processing, huge amounts of data to be able to understand what this person brings and what is out in the world. And it's just that those things haven't been connected yet. And that is a real opportunity that I think could make for much more successful matches, placements.
To yes, and to the trajectory that Emily has had in her role as partner now in this agency, I don't think she expected to be there for 5, 6 years. I think the mindset of most candidates, especially in their 20s and 30s, is like do a year and bounce. But if there's a reset, than it would be to hire someone well that grows with the company, that helps you grow the business, because collaborative rapport is more valuable than everything, I think, than anything else. I know several founders and serial founders who hire the same founding team over and over because that they have collaborative rapport with them. Means faster time to market, faster time to whatever the new problem is that they're configuring to solve. It feels to me like there will be a quantifiable way, probably with the collaboration of some AI tool that is not just about your skills and knowledge, but your company culture and the environment of your team, the management style of your manager, the are you an evening person or a morning person? How do you work best? If those things are part of the configuration, then we'll make more matches and more matches that will last longer.
It's a really, really interesting time. Okay, so last question. If you were if there is someone who is out there in the world right now looking for their next role, and they want to be thoughtful about it, they do want to get the role, but like, what is your piece of advice that you would give, given where we are and how crazy the market is?
My piece of advice on getting their next role. If it's not coming from LinkedIn or Indeed or a job search, maybe it's coming from someone that you know. Maybe it's someone that you already know that you've worked with in the past who can make an introduction for you or bridge that connection for you. And if it's not someone that you know and you don't know me or you, Josh, then reach out to me. I'm going to volunteer you as well. I think our networks are the thing that one of the things that we carry with us over our lives, especially valuable in an environment where a hiring manager has 10,000 resumes to look through and will give your portfolio 1 minute of review. That's a broken system. So if there's an intro, a warm intro that can be made to help you along your journey, then that's going to be part of the thing that will help you succeed, help you feel like you're not going it alone.
That's amazing, because what you're illuminating for me is that is the part of the system that we already have in place that we're talking, right? We're describing about something that grows and moves along with you, and that is what we should be leaning on to do everything that we need to do. And that's exactly right. And the network, that network, that's how we met,
That's why
right?
we're still here. There's a startup that I've been chatting with called Trove. It's the trove.io, I believe. Let me just double check that. What they're building is, it's the trove.io. What they're building is a way to demonstrate your value that carries with you over your career from job to job to job. Some of the proof of that, some of the content around that might get stuck in a Jira ticket or a Slack message or something, and it's not going to leave the company along with you when you're ready to leave. And I'm excited that this is a social proof approach to your value. It's exactly what's needed to begin to make LinkedIn slightly more useful and maybe another way to get to the network effect that we're talking through.
Amazing. Well, we're gonna have to leave it there.
All
Josh
right.
Silverman, founder and CEO of People Work Partners. You can learn about him and his amazing work at peoplework.partners. Josh Silverman, thank you so much for coming on Great Mondays Radio. This was amazing.
Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio. Hey, if you want to be a guest on our program, head over to radio.greatmondays.com and fill in the application. Have a friend you think would find this episode interesting? Send it to them. And while you're at it, rate and review. It really helps. I'd love to connect. Send me an email, josh@greatmondays.com. And if you're interested in learning more about how I help private businesses elevate how teams operate in an AI-driven world, check out greatmondays.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.